Yeah. We had the Chancellor Jim Casey, President of Johnson County Community College. A judge, honorary judge, Joe Crum from Colorado Hills, Topeka, and many others covering different topics. Today it will be Mother's Day, celebration of Mother's Day. We had a speaker to talk about our traveling experience, poetry, classical music, bullying at schools were some of the topics we had. What else? Annual Diokang Friendship Dinner that some of you probably have come a few weeks ago, April 7th, that brought together almost 30 different groups. In addition to having different faith communities, we had representatives from Harvesters Nathan Atkins Museum of Art, Johnson County Community College, Abida Park University, UMKC, Red Cross, Habitat for Humanity, and many others. We also have been organizing birthday parties at assisted living homes. This was a project started almost 14 months ago to honor the elderly people in the community. We organized monthly birthday parties at different assisted living homes in Lawrence and Kansas City. Okay, what else? What else you want to know? So the next month, we almost have a month for Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is coming. And so far we have more than 25 events scheduled, community dinners. We will publicize that soon also. And we will also have community festivity dinners, family dinners, free down meals at 2 a.m. You are interested. So that's a 30-day of celebration, like a more social gathering that you will have. And if you would like to hear more about Dialogue Institute and the events organized by Dialogue Institute, there is a sign-up sheet on the table to the left, the white sheet. Please put your full name and email address there if you are not in the emailing list. Okay, if you think one email is not enough, so just put your name another time. Okay, today our speaker will be Dr. Sophia Khan. To introduce her, I will invite Mr. Greg Ricky from St. Andrew Christian Church, who is also the advisory board member, the chair of Dialogue Institute. Please.
Well, in keeping with our hope at the Dialogue Institute, we do want this to be dialogue today and not monologue. So we hope that you will join in and participate as we get through our program. I do have a few preliminary statements that I wanted to make, and I don't think Ayub mentioned his name. It's Dr. Ayub Essen, and he's the head of the Cultural Center and a very active leadership person, along with Dr. Salahuddin Aydin, who is right here. Everyone knows these two great guys. So we at St. Andrew are just delighted to be involved and have the chance to co-host today's event. And some of you are new to our church, and we hope you'll come back often to visit us and to participate in programs like this. I've been involved with the Dialogue Institute for about 10 years now, and it's a great opportunity for our community to come together and listen to one another respectfully and with intention of hearing and sharing with one another. And I hope that's what we'll do today. Another aspect of what we're hoping to accomplish this morning has to do with the plight of refugees in our community. I think all of you are aware of this issue, and those of you who are members of our congregation, especially, I would like to invite you to come up and sign a letter to our governor of Kansas, pushing back against the rhetoric that's being used, and especially with respect to
refugees from Iran and Syria. There was one other country.
Afghanistan?
No,
sorry.
It was another country. Sudan, maybe. Is it Somalia? It was three countries I know that are excluded. And those of us who feel strongly about that issue, and I'm only inviting church members because the letter is from our denomination's regional office. So perhaps if there's sufficient interest, we'll have more about this topic in the future. I'd like to start with a couple of quotes from some Holy Scripture that I hope will sort of resonate and speak to our topic today. This comes from the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament of the Holy Bible. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That comes from the book of Leviticus. This is from the Quran. True righteousness is in one who believes in Allah, the last day, the angels, the book, and the prophets, and gives wealth in spite of love for it to relatives, to the needy, to the traveler. This also comes from the book of Hebrews in the Holy Bible. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. I can't read my own writing. And finally, from the New Testament, the book of Matthew, truly I say to you, as you did it for the least of my brethren, you did it for me. So these are holy books from different religions, and I'm sure that there are others from the Bhagavad Gita and other ancient scriptures, but it speaks to all of us and to our hearts to welcome the stranger. Now, we had hoped this morning that we would be hearing from a mother from Somalia. Unfortunately, she took ill last night, and she was in the emergency room with high blood pressure and some other manifestations that were quite concerning, so she's not able to be with us today. However, we have an outstanding speaker who I'm sure will be able to take up that time. And as you get to know Sophia, you'll understand that comment. And I'd like to just share with you briefly how I came to know this particular mother. She's going to speak about motherhood, and especially the motherhood of a person who's immigrated to this country. I'll give her a brief introduction in just a minute. St. Andrew has long been an advocate of interfaith dialogue and reaching out to people of other faiths in a way that we think we learn from each other, and we begin to think of each other as fellow travelers here on earth. And if we're lucky, we begin to become friends with one another. And, you know, the scientists mapped the genome a few years ago, maybe just 2 years ago, and they discovered that biologically, we human beings are 99.9% the same. And yet we tend to focus on that 0.1% that makes us different. And so, you know, if we start to think of each other as fellow human beings and finding the light in the other, we're never disappointed. That's been my experience. As part of our particular church's outreach, we have sponsored interfaith meals over the last few years, and I know there's one tonight. Is that right? And I was with a group and just happened to be assigned to Dr. Khan and her family. And so we exchanged dinners in each other's homes over the year, three or four times a year. And in the most recent dinner that we attended at the Khan's residence, after dinner, the other guests had gone home. And we stayed back for a little while, my wife, Beth, and me. And so I asked Sophia, I said, well, what do you do for fun? And she said, oh, I welcome refugees. And I thought, well, I've never heard that before. And I said, well, what does that look like? And she says, well, if you want to see it, come with me Wednesday. So Wednesday, I met her, and we visited the home of some, really recent refugees in like 2 weeks in our country. And they had been picked up in Cairo after being there for years and plopped into Kansas City with very little English, virtually no English, and $900, which was to last them for 3 months. And in that time, they were to learn the language, somehow put things together and make a home for their four children, and get a job. Now think about that. That's what these folks are expected to do. And then a few years later, we expect them to pay back the transportation costs and all the upfront costs. So we do welcome strangers. And our country has been very gracious in welcoming probably more strangers than any country on earth, perhaps now with the exception of Germany. Germany's taken in over 1 million, as you know. So we're still trying to figure out how to take in, 10,000 from Syria this year, and getting pushback from our politicians even for that. So anyway, when Sophia and I had met this family, I want to tell you a brief little story. I hope I'm not embarrassing you, but it so touched my heart. I just haven't been able to stop thinking about it. She first, through an interpreter, asked the lady of the house, first of all, she said, we welcome you to our city. I'm just an individual here. I don't represent a group. My name is Sophia. I'm a doctor. She's a medical doctor. And my friend Greg here is with the church, and we're just here to welcome you. And then she said, again through the interpreter, would you mind if we brought your children some gifts? And of course, when the translation came through, it was like, are you kidding? And so she started making a list of the things they needed. And remember, they were coming from a Mediterranean climate into, then this was in November, so winter was on the way. They didn't know what winter was. But they didn't have coats, they didn't have shoes, they didn't have blankets, basic things they needed. So Sophia was making a list of all these different things, and within a week she had delivered the things, the few just little essentials that they asked for. So this is her mission. This is her self-given mission. And before she left, she gave them a card with her name and her phone number. And she said, now, you will discover soon enough that medical care is difficult to find in our country, especially without insurance. And if you have trouble medically, I want you to call me and I will help you. Now, I haven't met too many doctors that make those kind of house calls, but she does. So. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Sophia. I'll just briefly introduce her to you. As I said, she's a physician. She's a mother of 5 daughters, so she's going to talk about motherhood today. She's been in Kansas City for 20 years. She's a community activist and involved in many, many charitable projects in the interfaith community. She did her medical training at Dow Medical College in Karachi University, and I think spent some time in school in this country.
We were training in New York.
In New York. So with that, I'm going to introduce my dear friend, Sophia Kahn.
It's always a pleasure coming to your church. You know, I'm just getting so used to it now. I know all the doors, the openings. I love the community here. And so today, our main speaker was supposed to be our friend, Somali friend, who is actually a ex-national basketball team player too, and she came here and got settled. Unfortunately, she was excited to be here, and now she can't be here because of her health issues, so I have to improvise. So I apologize already if I don't seem like, you know, I'm going in the flow, because I had to go to the hospital, see all my patients too before I came here. So I think I'll stay in the theme of Mother's Day and tell my story. As you can see, I'm a hijabi, Muslim, American physician. I moved to America when I was 19. My parents brought us here, and they went through the original struggles of being the immigrant family. I saw my mother struggle with the fact that she had left three kids back home. I was in medical school. My sister, younger to me, was starting medical school there, and then my older sister was married and just had her first baby. So her heart was split into two pieces, you know, half was in Pakistan and half was here with the other three kids that moved with her. And over those years before I moved here, I remember my dad telling me from time to time how she used to cry herself to sleep every night when she, you know, our parents nurture us too much, I think, in our culture. And then suddenly they had to move away and they were always concerned how we were doing. I was also very close to my parents, so it was difficult for me to live in a country without my parents being there. I completed my medical school and moved here. My husband Shabazz is in the room. We met in medical school actually, and he moved here and we got married in California. I finished my training in New York, and he got accepted in his training program at the same time when I was starting my first job here in Kansas City. And he did his training in psychiatry in UMKC. Since then, this is my 20th year here in Kansas City. I've had five girls. My oldest goes to first year KU, and my other four girls are sitting here on the table. My struggles as a mother were a little different than my mother's. I think all of us, when we become mothers, we do not have an actual book we can read. And I was telling my friend Donna that although with my first pregnancy, I had changed my dietary habits, I had kind of started to take life very seriously because I was going to be a mother. I did buy that book, What to Expect When You're Expecting. I'm not sure how much it helped, but I did read that book. But right after you have the first child, you know, you are just so nervous. Every 3 days we were at the doctor's office, and she said, oh, first-time parents, you know. Every little thing, we forgot we were physicians, we were just kind of freak out about it. That was the easy part. I think raising these girls, changing their diapers, and feeding them was the easy part. Now to think about when I'm raising four teenagers. They just transform. My kids sometimes say, Mommy, you treat us like we have a disease. And I said, yes, baby, and I have scientific evidence for it. And I do know it cures itself by age 21, so I'm just counting days. So right now I have four teenage daughters. Not just that I'm raising teenage American girls while trying to maintain my job, I'm also a minority. From a country where I was the majority, and you know, my mom didn't have to worry about raising us as Muslims or teaching us the values. The neighborhood taught us the values. You know, the school taught us the values because everyone was following those rules. It was about when I was having my fifth daughter that I went through some spiritual, I don't even know how to put it. Actually, you know, a lot of us take our religion for granted. We never bother to read our books and never bother to, because if you're born in it, you know, we just remember what my mom told me to do, pretty much. But a time comes in your life when you actually want to know, what is my faith all about? And that time came in my life too. It was about 10 years ago. I used to drive all the way to Liberty from South Leawood. I don't like listening to music much, so I found these old tapes. They were translation of my holy book. And I started listening to them repeatedly. And I realized some things I was doing wrong in my life that were I should correct to be a good Muslim. I always, you know, cherished my faith. And one of those things was covering my head and being more conservative in my dressing. So yes, I made that change. My oldest was about 9 years old, and I then gave birth to my fifth daughter. So my kids, as they were growing up, they now started seeing a mother who was wearing a headscarf and was dressing very conservatively, praying five times a day very regularly, And so it was a natural thing when my daughters went through their phase, when they become, passed into adulthood, that they realized, because they used to ask me, and I would say, yeah, baby, it's in our part of our faith to do it, that now I have three daughters that wear headscarves, and all my daughters dress up very conservatively. To raise such girls in an American environment where the society is going one way, and your mom's telling you to do something different, and then all the peer pressure, it's a struggle. It's a struggle, and I think it's not, for me, it's the hijab. For you, it might be keeping your kids off of drugs or certain kind of clothes or not to stay out of the house at a certain, everybody else is doing it. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is doing it, right? So this struggle of trying to raise, and then these are girls. Women in society already have to be very strong to just take care of themselves, let alone be strong mothers. They are good role models. They are the glue that keeps the family together. I take my role as a mother very seriously. Also the fact that I'm a role model for my girls. So if I had, my husband was making good money, he told me many times, if you want to quit the job, stay at home, be a, but you know what? How can I tell my girls to work hard, go to a good college, try to be a professional when they'll say, Mom, you're a professional. You're sitting at home. Why should I even bother to go to school? Or why should I bother to finish college? So I had to remember that part too. So over these years, I never quit my job. I tried to maintain my job also. So I'm a good role model. I always remember mothers, kids are going to almost, even if we don't want it, we do end up turning into our moms. Part of us is always turning. You know, a lot of times I say, Mommy, you're just talking like grandma. And I'm like, oh my God, I am. That's the only way we know how to be mothers. And plus, on top of that, we add stuff that we felt my mom should have done it this way. So I'm going to do it this way for my kids. So we're trying to improve on the motherhood of our parents, although we do love and appreciate them so much. So at this point, not just that I was struggling with my girls wanting to do something some way and the peers were doing it different, but also this pressure of the political rhetoric against the Muslims. And the sad part is the brunt of this falls on the hijabi women, because I can be identified very easily in a crowd of a million that I'm a Muslim woman. Although very small percentage of Muslim women actually wear headscarves, although they're required to, again, not everybody follows their faith the way they're supposed to. So majority of my family, I was the first one in my family to wear a headscarf. And the biggest pushback I got initially was from my own family and my immediate friends. What are you doing? You don't look nice anymore. You know, you have to do this, you have to wear like, you know, people don't like people, Muslims these days. You know, someone's going to do something to you. You drive in the car to Arkansas 5 times a year. You know, I used to drive a lot just with the kids. Shabazz was busy, so I used to just take the kids to visit my sister in Arkansas. And I had to pass through all small towns and stop at gas stations and stuff. You say, someone's going to kill you one of these days. Do you really want to keep? And because of that, a lot of women have actually taken off their headscarves over these years. And so this point has come several times with what's going on in my life, and now it's a point where I have to bring it up with my daughters, like after the San Bernardino attacks. You know, I called up my daughter at KU, I said, I worry for your safety. I worry for your safety. Do you think you should do something about maybe just wear some kind of other kind of head covering that's not as prominent? She said, I'm not going to hide who I am. You know, kids, first of all, teenagers, you can't even tell them what to do. And then now they have developed this strong identity. They are these strong women. And now you're telling them to hide yourself. First you teach them, be proud of who you are. And then you're telling them, hide your identity. It's a very difficult situation. People don't understand, even some of the Muslims who don't wear headscarves, they don't understand what the mothers are going through right now. And I was never afraid of dying. You know, I talk about death so much that my kids sometimes get sick of it. They said, Mommy, why do you have to talk about it? What if I'm not here tomorrow? What if I'm not? Mommy, don't say that. But now I worry because I'm a mother. I'm raising these girls. If something happens to me, you know, I worry about my kids, you know, because they're still young. And then I worry about my daughters. They are typical American kids, you know. They want to go out with their friends to movies. They play sports. They want to go out, you know, to the mall. They want to live a normal life. And every day they leave the house, as a mother, my heart is worried about their safety, more so than other mothers. because I feel there's a group of people who are targeting us, you know, and we are like, it's just very difficult for me to explain. You know, I don't want to start tearing up now, but I found my way as a mother, you know, and as a person of faith. We always find peace with God. And I have looked up through my scripture, talked to some scholars, and found out some special prayers that are for safety that you can make to God. And my day starts with those prayers at the crack of dawn, and my day ends with those prayers when sun sets. I take a special time, sit on my prayer rug, and I make special prayer for every human being, for every human being, for every mother. And I make special prayers for all my girls, that may God protect them. Because we are who we are, and my identity is not complete if I don't dress up the way I do. I feel more close to God like this. I feel I am giving up something which is a desire in every woman to look pretty and to be admired. I'm putting them to the side, and I'm putting my integrity, my talent ahead of that. And I think women are very talented. You know, we are no less than men in any field. You call it medicine, science, engineering, anything, and we do not need to be judged by what we look like. We should not be putting that much focus on what I look like today. Is my hair looking beautiful? Why does my husband doesn't care what his hair look like, or what his legs look like, or you know, what color, you know, why do women have to worry when we are as strong and as talented and more, in some ways more stronger than men? The number of things I can handle as a mother, you know, if I tell my kids, you know, wake up the kids, and I come home at 11, I'm like, what about breakfast? You just told me to wake them up. You didn't tell me to feed them too. You know, so it comes naturally to mothers. You know, we can do 15 things and also maintain the social life of our families. So as mothers, I think it's important for me, you know, I'm sure for every mother, is to remain a good role model for their kids. From the very first day the kids are born, we change ourselves. We change ourselves for better, so that when my daughter looks at me, she can see a strong woman, and you know, then eventually you'll reap the benefits of what you have sowed, because the kids will end up being exactly like I was mentioning to Donna, that my oldest daughter, you know, when I had my first head-to-head with her about something, I don't know if it was a political issue or what, and she stood her ground. I kept trying to convince her, but she kept telling me, no, I was wrong. I paused for a second. I thought about it. I was kind of a little bit upset with her at that point, but then I thought, I said, she's that exact same strong woman I worked so hard all these years for her to be. She's exactly what I wanted her to be. It doesn't matter, even if your parents are saying something wrong or you don't believe in it, you know, you got to stand for your rights and say. So now, even when my nine-year-old argues with me, on the face I might say no, but I'm feeling really happy on the inside. You know, it takes one day at a time, really, to deal with these kids. You know, you got to understand their moods. Oh, my child looks sad today. Maybe I should take her out. Or quietly, without offending her, without her feeling that I'm probing into her life, ask her, is everything okay? Do you want to talk to me, or do you want to talk to your sister about something, you know? For mothers, you know, every day is a new challenge with our kids. You know, every day you're always looking out for, did they sleep enough? Did they eat okay, you know? And we really hope that, like my second oldest, she's getting ready to go to college. And I was telling her, yesterday was her birthday too, and last day of school, and we had our mass and mother-daughter luncheon yesterday. And I told her, you know, when you're holding your kid in your hands and they're still in your nest, and then you let go of them. You know, when they go to college, you feel like you just let go and they fly. And I told her, I you're ready to fly. Don't think that, you know, she always feels like, Mommy, you think I won't be able to do it. I'm like, no, you are ready to fly. And I look forward to seeing you fly and just waving at you. And I think our dreams as mothers are no different, whether I'm a Muslim or Christian or Hindu or immigrant or a refugee. All the mothers are pretty much the same. Their desires are just to nurture their kids, turn them into strong human beings, and then just let go and watch them as they fly. there is a bigger challenge, you know, I always, refugees are always on my mind, but they have a bigger challenge than us. Okay, so they were having a normal life, struggling, trying to keep life day to day, sometimes in much harsher environments than the comfortable life we have here. And on top of that, someone is trying to kill you. You know, bombs are falling on your head. Now suddenly you have to grab your kids with the last couple of things, to stuff some money in your pocket and run. And run as far as you can, sometimes starving, sometimes thirsty, sometimes with no shoes on. And then try to find a place of safety for you and your family. And sometimes they struggle for years. The thing different about the Syrians is their wounds are fresh. These are the people who suffered. For some Somalians and stuff, it could be because they might have even been born in those refugee camps. They don't even know what it's like to be part of a country, part of a normal environment. So as a mother, you know, and all the mothers in this room, you know, we can feel the suffering of a mother who's just trying to have a normal life for her kids. Her dreams are no bigger, like she doesn't want a castle or anything like that. She just wants her kids to be able to go to school, to be able to eat regular food, you know, not to see her kids starve. Like in some of these places, you know, the pictures are just, oh, I mean, they rip my heart open. You know, when I see a mother holding a child who's dying of hunger, it's like skin and bones, and she has nothing to give to that child. We can only imagine. Just looking at those pictures is hard for us, for people who've been through all of that. So, you know, with Greg and Donna and myself, and we have another friend, we have decided to see what we can do, at least for the refugees that enter the city through the UNHCR program. They are bought in by our government. They are bought in after they've been scrutinized and all the security stuff they have passed. And now they're entering through our airport with hopes and desires of a better life. And the last thing we can do to them is to demonize these people, to tell them, we don't want you here. You know, they've been through enough. This was their last hope. This is pretty much their last hope of a normal life. So all we can do is welcome them. It's not difficult to welcome these people. It doesn't take a whole lot out of our budget or out of our time or out of our energy. Very simple ways, you know. So we have started a mission called Kansas City for Refugees, in which our goal is to, it's actually fourfold. We are going to educate our community about how safe these programs are, and not to be afraid of these people. And we will explain to them exactly how these programs work from the time a person becomes a refugee to the moment they enter here, the whole process they go through, so you can be comfortable that you don't need to be afraid of these people. And to be able to have you guys actually meet these people, listen to their stories, you know. Donna is working on meeting with some of these families and telling their story on our Facebook page also. So you know actually who our neighbors are, what kind of sufferings they went through, what hopes they brought here, and how they have contributed back to our community. Statistically, I was reading a study, and I have to get the exact name of the study for you, where they show that the countries that take in refugees, the economy actually grows. And the crime rate, majority, especially in our country, of refugees getting involved in crimes is like negligible. These people have just been through so much pain and suffering. All they want is to have, and they are so thankful when they actually are received by people, taken to an apartment where furniture and food and clothing is ready for them. They are very thankful, and they want to give back to the community as much as possible. These people get involved in community service work quite regularly, you know. Most of the volunteers at Della used to be refugees on their own, and when they found jobs, whatever time they can find, they come back and they volunteer for those agencies to help other refugees. So these are amazing people. The more you see them, the more you love them. I'm at a point where if I don't see a new family, when I don't see a new family within at least twice a month, I feel like I'm missing something in my life, you know. I keep calling them, is there a family that I can come and see now? Because as soon as they come, they have to have this tight schedule of paperwork and stuff they have to go through. So after typically about 2 weeks, they let you come and visit them. And then after that, you can visit them as much as you want. So just going and visiting these people opens our eyes. So part of our program is to connect the community with those refugees, either by visits as you want to do on your own, or by even organizing events. Like if you had an event like this and you wanted a couple of refugee families to just come and break bread with you, just sit on a table, you could just go say hi to them. They don't even have to talk much. We're going to do once a year dinners, and the youth is going to organize once a year barbecues. We're hoping in Luce Park, because the place is big enough and you know there's room for all of us. We can just barbecue and invite them over. So that is another part of our goal, is to connect our community with these actual refugee families that live in our neighborhoods. So we develop a bond with them. We help them as they need help through these agencies. There are three agencies in Kansas City, one on the Kansas side, Catholic Charities, and two on the Missouri side, Jewish Vocational Services and Della Lam. I personally have been involved with Della Lam for some time as an activist and as a volunteer. And they have recently offered me a place in their board of directors, and I'm actually very honored to get involved more with their work because they do an awesome job helping their community. Other than that, we are also going to get connected with such regional and national level efforts that are going on in the country already. We will be an inspiration to them, and they will help guide us to how make Kansas City more welcoming to the refugees. We need our politicians to hear this. You know, they think everybody in Kansas City hates refugees. They think everybody in Kansas City don't want refugees here. And we need to make this clear to them that that is not true. We are not afraid of sharing our bread with them or putting a hand of comfort just on their shoulder and saying, welcome to Kansas City. You're fine now, you know, you're safe, and everything will be okay. You know, it's not hard to do that. It's not hard to do that. All we can do as donations too is just give our used furniture. So if you're moving and you have extra chairs sitting in the basement you haven't used for 20 years and you know you don't want them in your new house, that's all it takes. Old furniture, your hand-me-down clothes, your shoes, your jackets, you know, stuff we want to get rid of because we want to fill our closets with the stuff that's in style now, right? And the closets are oval full, right? I mean, I have a bag in each kid's closet all the time that we keep filling up, and I say, when you buy more clothes, stuff some in here, you know, share. And now that we know that it's not going to end up in the landfill, you know, we are more generous in the kind of stuff we give them because they actually cherish it. And one thing these kids love is toys, yes. And we all have rooms and rooms full of toys. Books, you know, books if you want to give them books. So it's almost fun once or twice a year having some kind of donation drive. And if you want, you can visit them and drop off this stuff, which is a lot of fun. Especially handing the toys to the kids. I love that part. And the story I love the most, I'm looking at the time, I'm not gonna go over the time, is the story I had of a family. I believe they had maybe 7 or 8. I sometimes mix up the kids. They all have a lot of kids. They have a lot of kids and the wife is always pregnant. It's funny, on my way out, sometimes I have to tell the guys, it's enough now, please, leave her alone. Because 8, 9 kids and she's still pregnant, you know? So anyways, once I was visiting a family, I'd taken a few soccer balls and dolls and stuff with me, whatever I could grab from Target on my way there. And although we left most of the stuff packed in bags, I said, I want to open up the toys and hand them myself because I love that smile when I see on their faces. And they give me the little hugs and, you know, their special gestures from their countries, which is so cute for Somali. They always come and kiss your hand, you know. The kids come and hold your hand and kiss it. So all those little cultural things, I love it so much. And I always get a good cup of tea, too, when I go there. So I handed a soccer ball to this little kid, and I was about to leave. And then I usually don't speak their language because they're here, they're very new, and I have to take a translator through the agencies with me to communicate. So he said, before I left, the dad stopped me, and he said, my son we have been seeing soccer on TV in the refugee camps all these years. They might have some community room or something where they were able to see soccer. And he said, this is the first time my kid has held a soccer ball. It just kind of gave me the shivers, you know. I'm like, oh my God, you know. My kids throw the balls in the backyard and I have to tell them 20 times to bring them in. You know, it's amazing how many things in life we take for granted. And over these years, you know, I have always left my card, always told them, this is my phone number, call me if you need anything. And other than one person calling me, you know, they never called me. You know, you would think that they would call you and say, I want this and I want that. No, no, they're not greedy. They're very content, you know. Once we, actually it was with Aaron. We went to see a family. It was a Christian family from, I believe it was from Congo, Sudan. They had 8 or 9 kids. And we went in there and we sat down and they knew we were coming. They had dressed up the kids to the best they could. They had some snacks ready for us. And when we were there, we said, is there anything we can do to help you? Please, you know, you have all these kids. You just got here a week ago. Anything we can bring for you. And the husband said, and by the way, that wife was pregnant too. She had 9 kids in the house and she was pregnant, 5 months pregnant. And he said, you have no idea that we come into this country, we don't know anybody, we are nervous, and for you, strangers, just coming into our house and saying, welcome to the city, it means everything to us. It means so much, I can't even explain. He then started giving us blessings, and he said, may God bless you and your family, and you know, give you everything you want, and I will make prayers for you. And he said that you have no clue what you've done for us today. Just by visiting us, you know, and you strangers coming here especially to see us with toys in the bag for my kids. So this is what happens. This is what happens when you visit these people. If you are at the airport or something, you know, this is really, you make a big difference in somebody's life who's already very nervous. You know, he's in a new country. They don't speak the language. They don't know. They are hearing probably stuff in the news already that people might not want us there. They are nervous if they're going to have a job or not. And then suddenly the doorbell rings and somebody comes in with a bag of goodies, right? And say, welcome to my city. So there's so much everybody, each and every one of you in this room can do to make a difference. You know, these people will never forget that visit. Even 10 years from now, they will always remember that stranger that greeted them when they first arrived here. That's how an impact these things make, how big an impact. And they will always have a special place for Americans and people of Kansas City in their heart. They will never forget that one person, because when I go in there, I always tell them, I represent the city. I'm a self-proclaimed representative of the city when I go in there. I said, I represent the people of Kansas City, and I want to tell you that we all welcome you here. So I think it's these little things make a big difference. And so we have started a Facebook page called KC for Refugees, and we're going to have a separate program for youth in there. And very soon after all of you are done with your finals and I can pull some youth into this work, we will start a separate youth page, and I already have a Jewish leader who's ready to be the lead person for the youth program. And we are going to do 2 things under the youth program. One is going to be getting hygiene kits ready. So when the new families come, we will try to visit them maybe at the airport or right before they arrive and deliver these, the youth can deliver the hygiene kits themselves. So they do their own fundraising and create the hygiene kits. We will tell them the families coming, how old the people, each and every person's gender and age, so you can put some toys, maybe dollar store toys or something in that packet too. And a once a year barbecue the youth will organize on their own. We will support them in every way and we'll bring the families there. So youth program with their own separate Facebook page and stuff will be starting pretty soon. And adult, obviously, you know, there's always room for people who are wanting to go and greet these people at the airport. They're coming like every week almost. Through the agencies, probably every day. So if anyone wants to sign up, we are planning to start a greeting team also that can just go with a flower and maybe a couple of toys. You know, we can tell them exactly what the genders and ages of the people coming are. And if you have time, we can start a separate email pool of just the people who are interested and just shoot them the times and dates of the refugees arriving. And that could be something done very easily. And then obviously donating, the word of mouth, donating when you're moving. Your furniture, we'll do a winter clothing drive, we'll do a spring drive, we'll do a back to school drive. After 3 months, these agencies are not required to help them anymore, but the refugees still need help. So the community that settles and becomes part of Kansas City, they still need help. So we can always stay in touch with them, we can, you know, have some kind of contact with them and still ask them, if you need anything, let us know. And stay in touch with them, you know, stay in touch with them and find them jobs or whatever, you know. There's a lot of ways we can help.
Can you talk about the abodes for your students?
Oh yes, the first Syrian family that arrived. That was a beautiful experience. So for all this time that I've been involved with Del Alam, I'm very passionate about this refugee thing. So if you're sitting on the bleachers watching your daughter play with my daughter, I will be talking about the refugees. You know, if I'm at a dinner party, I'm talking about it. So over these years, a lot of people, when they heard about it, say, hey, can you come up to our church and tell us what this refugee, who are these refugees that live in Kansas City? So I started doing some programs with Del Alam, and I would do a speaker program. A representative from Del Alam would come, describe the UNHCR process, and I would talk about how the community could get involved. I was getting a lot of questions about Syrians. People would say, yeah, we want to help refugees. How about a Syrian family? Is there a Syrian family we can help? Because there was a lot of stuff going in the media, especially when the two-year-old boy got drowned. People were feeling it in their hearts, and they felt that if I can personally, physically help a Syrian family, it would make me feel good. You know how sometimes we want to do that? So I would ask Della, and they said, sorry, no Syrians yet. So obviously, when the first Syrian family was about to come, I first got a call because they were concerned if the community was ready for it or not. They were concerned because they had some health problems. Their father and one of the five-year-old twins' son had open-heart surgery when he was little. So they were concerned if they could support them or not. So they asked me for some community support before they could approve the application. And I said, sure, we will figure out community support. You let them come. So I said, worst-case scenario, I'll pay for it. Just let them come, please. And so when the family arrived, in 3 weeks we found out they were coming. We thought they'll come probably in 12 to 24 months, which is the usual turnaround time. But this apparently was a family that was coming under the surge. So their application got approved, and within 3 weeks they were going to be at the airport. Like, whoa, I thought I had a year to do the fundraising. I said, no, I have no time. I got to start collecting the money. So when they arrived at the airport, a few days before that we found out all the media was following them too. So we had to deal with the media, plus trying to get the family settled. The kind of response we got from the Kansas City people was amazing. It was heartwarming. And that's what started the whole Kansas City for Refugees. We realized people who were calling us, they just did not want to just donate their shoes or clothes. They wanted to get involved in helping the refugees, and they needed some kind of platform. And that's how we created Kansas City for Refugees. The family on their own, they're doing well. They are very thankful. They're amazing people. The dad did get involved in a bomb accident there. He was at a marketplace when a bomb fell, and the pieces of metal, you know, these are barrel bombs in which they fill pieces of metal and nails and screws in it, and he puts explosive in it and just throws them at people. So the pieces of metal go inside their body, and he got injured quite bad. And some of the emergency response local volunteer physicians had taken off some of the metal out, but some metal is still in his body. And although he kind of didn't want to talk about it too much, when I kind of probed him and asked him, you have to tell me, I'm a doctor, what kind of problems you have? He told me all night he has severe pains in those parts of his body where metal is still there. So we have a physician who has offered to do a physical on him, x-rays and stuff, to see where he's going to be, if he's going to need disability benefits. Before, he got offered 2 or 3 jobs already, but you know, in this heat, if he starts working, you know, we're concerned. Children's Mercy was kind enough to push, usually their wait time for appointment is 9 months, but a friend of ours talked to the cardiologist and he got him in within 5 days and got a complete cardiac evaluation, everything on him, and cleared him, and has said he can see him every 6 months. There's a dentist in the community, Brother Abu does not have any teeth. He always laughs about it. He said, I try to smile. We always say, you're always smiling. He said, I can't smile, I have no teeth. He just had 2 or 3 like dark stubs in his mouth. So one of the dentists offered that she's going to take care of all his dental work. And I am so proud to say that Sion, which I tell people, this is the school where my girls go, the Catholic school. And I tell everyone, if I had to go back 10 years and do it again, I would do it again the same way. I would put my girls in Sion. I love Sion. Sion's teachers, obviously I'm close with a bunch of the teachers there, and we were at a science competition in Colombia. What was that, Inaya? What was it? Science Olympiad. Yeah, we finally made it to the regional, so we were there. I was talking about the refugees and the Alabooth family. I come back and I'm part of their mission group, and she says, Sion wants to have these kids come to our school for free. I'm like, are you sure? Because I pay the tuition. I know how much the tuition costs. And she said, oh, by the way, how many kids do they have? I'm like, oh, okay. So this is how many they have. She said, yes, we've talked about it. And Sion, if they want to come to Sion, we will let them come tuition free. So you girls should be very proud of being part of Sion right now. And I gave her a big hug. I said, you just saying that means so much. Because right now, obviously, they don't drive. You know, where they're going to live is still an issue. But just for them to offer that. So this is what Kansas City is. You know, I was taking them around in the community and having them visit people when I realized it was like, you know, one of those days when it was warm again. And the kids were wearing sweater dresses and with winter boots. And the kids were like melting, the little ones. And I said, why didn't you put summer clothes on them? They said, we don't have any summer clothes. We left from Syria all the money I had left over in Amman. They came from Amman, right? They said, we just bought these winter boots because we thought Kansas City was going to be really cold. And, you know, they didn't realize here it's, you know, weather is everything every day. And so we had to run a friend over to buy some shoes for them immediately for some clothes. But then down the road, I said, they need some more shoes because they just have like maybe one pair each that I bought immediately for them. So this friend who was going to take them around just walked into a price, Payless, and introduced them, said, these are refugees. And by the way, if you've heard about it, you know, they're almost become a celebrity by now. They said, this is the first Syrian family. Would you like to help them? And the guy gave a 35% additional discount on the sale prices and gave them free socks. So for the budget we had on the donation money, which was $250, we were able to buy 2 to 3 pairs of shoes for each one of them. So this is the generosity of Kansas City. They were at a Chick-fil-A having lunch, and this gentleman comes up to them and says, I saw you on TV. Are you that first Syrian? He said, the translator was with him, his friend, who's become his close friend. And the guy goes out and buys a $50 Chick-fil-A gift card and gives it to him. So this is, and they're getting letters from all over the country right now welcoming them to America, sometimes with money and checks in it. So, you know, this is what real America is. You know, that's what the real people of America are. They have a big heart and they understand the pain and suffering of other humans, because we are humans before we are anything else, you know? Before we are black or white or Muslim or Jewish or Hindu, we are humans. And everybody understands that. There is a special secret bond among us that makes us feel the suffering of other people. And that's what's making this such an amazing experience for us who are experiencing it. You know, we're getting phone calls and emails. There hasn't been a single community leader that we met and asked them to join this cause, and they're already on board. They were already on board. So this has been a beautiful experience, and I'm a little bit above my time, so I'm going to say thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sophia Khan. God gives us love and compassion for free. I think we should not feel shy about sharing this love and compassion with different people. One thing to add about Sophia Khan and her husband there, they treated us dinner 2 weeks ago to me, my friend, my friend's friend, and his friend. So just get to know them, please. In the buffet, yeah. To close the program, before closing the program, there is another great program soon organized by American Friends Service Committee. And I will have Dr. Spencer Graves to announce the program.
Thank you very much. A week from this coming Thursday, May 19th, there's a flyer on your table. There'll be a program on confronting extremist violence, the refugee crisis and fear, faith responses. It'll be a panel, it's an interfaith panel with 5 speakers. The primary panel is Dr. Vernon Howard, who's with the Southern Poverty, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City, Fadi I'm not certain how to pronounce his last name, but you can read it there, is with the Islamic Society of Greater Kansas City, Rabbi Linda Stegman of the Rabbinical Association of Greater Kansas City, Father Paul Turner, who was specifically recommended by the Roman Catholic Bishop Johnston. They'll be preceded, but with a presentation from Lieutenant Colonel Brian Steed, who was on the Army Command and General Staff College faculty at Leavenworth. He's fluent in Arabic. He's served as an officer in the in an exchange program in the between the U.S. military and the Jordanian military. He's been been to Iraq many times. He's got a book coming out, Mesopotamia on Fire. There'll be a reception at 6 o'clock and presentation at 6:30. I hope you can all make it. And if you've got in any place you can distribute other excess flyers, I have them. Thank you.
Thank you. Special for Mother's Day, we have roses. Our friends, Turkish moms, will distribute roses to every mom. Please take your flower when you leave. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.